Good morning, Green Valley News, for Monday, the 15th day of June. Mark DeGroft with you here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. A former Town of Sorita employee pleaded guilty on Friday to theft and could be sentenced to probation of up to 8 3/4 years in prison in July. Joe Marty Jr., who worked for the Public Works Department, was indicted in September of 2025 on 8 felony counts related to crimes he was accused of committing from May of 2023 through December of 2024. According to his indictment and the Sorita Police Department reports, detectives believe Marty used fellow employees' town-issued fuel cards for personal use, used his town-issued purchasing card to acquire equipment he later sold, and that he pawned a piece of surveying equipment that belonged to the town. All told, he was accused of stealing more than $27,000 over a 3-year period, and he was fired shortly after his arrest in March. Pima County Superior Court Judge Richard Gordon will sentence Marty on July 13th. Restitution will be addressed at that point as well, Pima County Superior Court spokesman James Pollock said. Shortly after Marty was arrested, Town Manager Shane Dill and Police Chief John Nolan said that their investigation revealed that Marty was a trusted employee who received high marks on his performance evaluations, and those factors enabled him to carry out his crimes. According to Nolan, Sorita Mayor Tom Murphy received an anonymous voicemail on his cell phone on December 7th of 2024, alleging Marty was getting kickbacks from a local concrete company, that Marty was using his own town purchasing card to buy fuel for personal vehicles, and that an upper-level manager in the town protects Marty. Murphy contacted Dill, who in turn contacted Nolan. They immediately launched an investigation with only themselves and Navarette in the loop. Ultimately, 2 more detectives joined Navarette in given the scope of what he finally found. Navarette quickly discovered the anonymous call came from Marty's estranged wife, whose records show had filed for divorce a day earlier. Navarette also discovered surveillance recordings showing Marty using town fuel cards to purchase gas for the couple's personal vehicles in Tucson and in Sorita. In addition, Navarette learned by running Marty's name through a database that he sold a 22-year-old piece of surveying equipment to USA Pawn in Tucson for $500. At the time it was purchased, the Nikon DTM-350-5 total station was valued at $5,900. In the end, the grand jury did not indict Marty or anyone else in connection with the kickback allegations. In addition to placing 2 employees on personal involvement improvement plans for failing to follow policies and procedures that were already in place, the town sought to improve their system of checks and balances, according to Dill. Among the actions being taken by the town, they're moving forward with a plan to purchase upgraded software to improve inventory tracking, creating a policy that requires all contractors to provide detailed invoices about the work they've completed rather than accepting lump sum invoices, implementing more stringent background checks. They're now looking at incidents and complaints in addition to criminal convictions. And they're tightening purchasing controls to ensure that every transaction is verified and documented. If an employee loses a receipt, a department head needs to sign the employee's memo of explanation. In addition, if an employee fails to turn in a receipt more than twice in a fiscal year, their purchase card is revoked. Dill said that Marty failed to turn in proper receipts more than 40 times in 2 years. And purchase cards are no longer issued to frontline staff. Every purchase is now reviewed by 2 people in the relevant department and by 1 person in the finance department. And employees are no longer allowed to have packages delivered to their homes, and everything purchased from Amazon is now processed through finance. The town is now promoting its fraud and ethics hotline more strenuously, beginning at the onboarding process. The Pima County Sheriff's Department is still looking for a man who discharged a gun at a garage sale in Green Valley and injured 2 people back on May 15th. According to a Pima County Sheriff's Department report, the 2 men, ages 61 and 35, were at a yard sale on West Paseo del Canto, south of Continental Road, when they asked Clarence Botiford if he had any weapons for sale. The man said Botiford went to his vehicle, brought back a 1923 Winchester rifle. According to the report, one of the men said Botiford had put the magazine back into the firearm and must have forgotten there was live ammo loaded into it. The man told deputies Botiford was in the process of demonstrating the trigger couldn't be pulled if the chamber was open when the chamber closed and the gun discharged. The man said Botiford then grabbed the rifle and fled in an older white van. One of the men sustained injuries to his right hand, his groin, and thigh. An other man was struck by a ricochet or debris in the stomach. They both required surgery. A warrant was issued for Botiford with charges that include aggravated assault and being a prohibited possessor. And according to the report, Botiford is homeless and had received permission from the homeowner to have a garage sale there. He also received his mail at that home. A Tucson man accused of killing a Suarita resident 2 years ago was found not guilty by a Pima County jury on Thursday. The jury deliberated 3 hours over 2 days. Douglas Goff, 66 years old, was accused of first-degree murder in the May 2024 death of Terry Parker, who was 51. Parker was found dead on May 17th of 24 of 2 gunshot wounds in his bedroom at the East Calle Minerva in the La Jolla Verde neighborhood by a relative who was concerned that he and his mother, Nancy Stonehouse, hadn't shown up for her doctor's appointment. Deputy Pima County attorneys Shelby Iguallo and Brad Terrace told jurors text messages found on Parker's cell phone indicated he had arranged to get cocaine from Goffin the evening before the body was found, and a bag of cocaine was found in his bedroom. In addition, they said the gun used to kill Parker was found in Goff's garage and Goff's DNA was on the slide and the trigger. However, Goff's defense attorney, Mark Resnick, told jurors Florida detectives erred when they focused exclusively on Goff as a suspect, and he suggested there were other potential suspects, including Parker's half-brother, a married girlfriend named Treva, Treva's other boyfriend, and her husband. He also suggested the original source of the cocaine could have killed Parker. Detectives didn't find the gun in Goff's house either, Resnick said. They found it in his garage, which was inaccessible from the outside to anybody. Prosecutors were also never able to show that Goff had a motive to kill Parker, Resnick said. The defense attorney suggested that Treva, a known drug addict, could have killed him over drugs or money. He also noted there was evidence that her other boyfriend became jealous when he learned that she planned to go to a concert in Phoenix with Parker on the following weekend, and therefore he had a motive to kill Parker too. Suarita detectives never subpoenaed any of the alternate suspects' phones for potential evidence or to check their alibis, Resnick said. One of the suspects gave them a phone to examine, and they just accepted it that it was his, she said. Resnick also took exception to the fact that Detective Ivan Cota interviewed Treva and told her that if she didn't say she was involved, he was going to detain her. On Tuesday, under Resnick's cross-examination, Detective James Velasquez testified that he was unaware that Parker's half-brother, Jason Stonehouse, had taken Parker to court because he believed Goff was neglecting their mother, who was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. Stonehouse also believed Goff was financially exploiting their mother and had sold a vehicle out from underneath him, Resnick said. Velasquez testified he had never interviewed Stonehouse, and Stonehouse's phone was never examined to verify his whereabouts in and around the time it's believed Parker was killed. Pima County Superior Court Judge Richard Garden presided over the trial. Parker and Goff were friends for years, and Goff's DNA could have ended up on the gun at any point during that friendship. In order to prove Goff killed Parker, prosecutors would have to prove Goff handled the gun on May 16th or 17th of 2024, but they failed to do so, he said. A Suarita Police Department sergeant has pleaded guilty to 2 counts of misdemeanor endangerment in connection with a Marana shooting range incident that put a grandmother and her grandson in harm's way. According to Pima County Superior Court records, Sergeant Aaron Medina could be placed on probation for up to 3 years on each count. He could also be sent to jail for 6 months on each count instead or as a condition of probation. The sentences could run concurrent or consecutive to each other. Pima County Superior Court Judge Christopher Browning is scheduled to sentence Medina on July 2nd. On October 15th of 2025, seven officers and three firearms instructors were participating in a three-day training at the Abrams Airborne Manufacturing Incorporated shooting range that is located in Marana. AAMI leases the land from BKW Farms. During training, a round escaped the range and struck a child's pull-up bar at Gladden Farms Community Park and forced a woman and her grandson to take cover. The police investigation revealed the round escaped while officers were firing rifle rounds on a pistol range. The officers were trying to qualify from distances of 100, 75, 50, 25, 15, and 7 yards. A shell casing was found at the 15-yard shooting line, and a drone measured the distance from that casing to the pull-up bar at 3,307 feet, or about 1,102 yards. That is about 5/8 of a mile. According to a 55-page Oro Valley Police Department report, instructors had decided to move from the rifle range to the pistol range due to flooding at the range. None of the officers who agreed to be interviewed thought it was odd when the instructors decided to move from the rifle range to the pistol range. None of them thought it odd when they were told to move their targets away from the backstops either. In fact, some said they had done so while in the military or working for other law enforcement or correction agencies, according to the report. Oro Valley PD came to the conclusion that it was Medina who made the decision to move those targets. An expert firearms instructor, Joshua Korn, was asked by investigators for his opinion on the incident. In his opinion, the incident was simply geometry issue based on how far back targets and shooters were from the berm, along with various positions and angles shooters shoot from during training played and a role in this incident, according to the report. Had Medina been convicted of felony endangerment, he could have lost his Arizona Peace Officer certification, according to State Administrative Code and the Arizona Police Officer Standards and Training Board. Well, if you use one of the county's free charging stations to fill up your electric vehicle, prepare to reach for your wallet in the future. Pima County is working on a software installation at its free EV charging stations countywide. It would allow it to charge users a minimal fee to cover costs. Facilities Manager Director Tony Cisneros said that the county has three public EV stations south of Tucson at the Suarita Library, the Joyner Green Valley Library, and the Saviglia Aravaca Library. He said all county-managed libraries have had the free public EV stations. There are some libraries under the City of Tucson's facilities management that are still without stations. Once we get the software, we'll install it, and our game plan is to just recover the electricity costs and some of the admin fees, Cisneros said. The county doesn't track countywide electrical usage for EV charging through a single ledger line, but Cisneros and the Green said that the Green Valley Station operates on a dedicated EV-only utility meter. He said the Green Valley Stations had an annual approximate energy consumption of 33,000 kilowatt hours, which costs roughly $6,000. TEP, which provides the power to the Green Valley Stations, reported that the average monthly consumption for a residential customer is 805 kilowatt hours or 9,600 kilowatt hours annually. The county EV stations are level 2 units that average $4,700 per charger. The county spent $42,960 for the four dual port stations at the Green Valley Library, $22,480 for the station at Aravaca's Library, and $21,480 for the Suarita Library. A level 2 charger can take an electric vehicle from empty to 80% in 4 to 10 hours. The county opened the Green Valley EV station in March of 25 and Suarita and Aravaca's in May and July of 2024, respectively. Facilities Manager reported its cost at about $1,000 per plug annually after including maintenance and electricity. The department said that comes out to about $14,000 for the 14 charger plugs that are in the county's southern area. P Pima County has 4 charges across all county managed libraries. Cisneros said the move to start charging the public is an evolution from a localized pilot phase to a unified system with real-time monitoring and centralized oversight. He said the initial goal was to also get people to start using them and reduce carbon emissions within the county. Right now it's free and we just had to get out in front of it and make sure that we had plenty of chargers for our own fleet, Cisneros said. He said the other issue is getting the right software to charge users that works with EV stations across the manufacturers. Some of these manufacturers are really proprietary, Cisneros said. It's hard to land on more than just one and make it simple. So that's where we've been and that's where we're at right now. We're getting close to getting it done. Cisneros said the department doesn't have a hard deadline to start charging, but he hopes to have them start implementing it within a month. EV stations are not entirely new to Pima County. The county announced in 2011 that it had planned to install 16 stations at its libraries as part of a network of 125 that were aimed at boosting electric vehicle use. The county began modernizing the EV stations to a level 2 units during the last few years as they continued to of the Board of Supervisors approved climate plan that began in 2007 and continued through successive resolutions, including one in May of 2025, directing county operations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 60% below 2021 levels by 2030. Cisneros said the EV stations for county operations and the public are a step in the right direction in meeting climate action goals. He said the EV stations have been more work for the department, but they still found that they're working out great. I mean, we're saving on fuel costs, especially right now, he said. But yeah, we make it work. We make it work, and it's not an option. It's 13 minutes in front of 10 o'clock here at Sun Sounds. A Tucson man, upset about his wife cheating on him, was arrested on domestic violence and drug charges last month after his wife reported that he had kidnapped their 5-year-old daughter. According to a Pima County Sheriff's Department report released on June 4th, the man's wife called 911 about 10 o'clock in the evening on May 23rd from the Comfort Inn at Interstate 19 and Esperanza Boulevard to report the kidnapping. During subsequent interviews, the woman explained that she had left her daughter with him, telling him she was going to spend the night with her mother in Green Valley, the report stated. However, she said her husband, who is 35 years old, must have tracked her cell phone because he turned up at the Comfort Inn where she had met her boyfriend after having dinner with him in Vail, the report stated. The Green Valley News and Sun is not releasing the name of the man to protect the identities of the victims. After giving her daughter a hug, the man placed the girl back inside his pickup, according to the woman. According to the report, the woman said he then confronted her, told her she had never seen the 5-year-old or their other daughter who wasn't present again. When she reached into the truck to grab the 5-year-old, the woman said her husband pushed her and fled the parking lot, leaving skid marks, according to the report. The woman said she feared for the safety of both of her daughters and said that the suspect had pointed a gun at her 2 months previously. She also told deputies she started divorce proceedings, but her husband hadn't been served yet and he wasn't aware that she had started the proceedings. Deputies and detectives flooded the area to try to locate the man and the girl. They were also given the whereabouts of the couple's 12-year-old daughter, thinking he might be heading there, the report stated. Deputies found the man's empty pickup truck across the street from the Comfort Inn, but there was no sign of the girl or her father. After a 2-hour search, a deputy on his way back to the San Javier district found him and the girl walking on the northbound shoulder of I-19. The little girl told a detective her dad had been spying on her mom, and she didn't want him to go to jail. She said she wanted to stay with her daddy, and she asked the detective if he was mad at her dad. In addition, the girl said she almost slept in a tunnel, and at one point her father had given her his shirt because she was cold and walked with her on his shoulders. According to the report, the girl said that she, too, was upset that her mom had a new boyfriend and they had seen her mom hugging him. The man denied any physical altercation took place. When asked why he abandoned his truck, he explained he was too emotionally upset to drive and decided to walk to a convenience store at Duval Mine Road and I-19 in order to clear his head and charge his phone. According to the report, the man said he didn't go back to his truck because he saw a lot of law enforcement in the area. He was arrested and booked into the Pima County Jail on suspicion of misdemeanor domestic violence and endangerment and misdemeanor domestic violence disorderly conduct. He's also facing two felony charges, promoting prison contraband and possession of narcotic drugs, after jail personnel found two baggies of cocaine in one of his pockets. And this is an article titled, Pioneer's Remains Could Be Moved for Expansion. It's written by Kevin Murphy. I will not get through this whole thing, but I'll complete it on Wednesday. A Quail Creek housing expansion has triggered a search for the descendants of Nelson Sawyer, a homesteader buried on the property over a century ago. The search opens a window into the history of the Santa Cruz Valley, and it raises questions about the town Suarita approved when it approved a 72-acre site. Several months into construction, a developer for Robson Resort Communities halted the work near Sawyer Cemetery, a 9-by-15-foot burial plot, enclosed by a low adobe wall where Nelson's body rests and the ashes of his widow Florence Gorman were spread. Robson, owner of the tiny parcel, has triggered a mandatory state process in order to move forward with its plans. A legal notice published on May 24th and June 7th set a 60-day deadline for Sawyer's lineal descendants or the next of kin to come forward. If there's no response by July 23rd to the notice published online and in the Green Valley News, Robson has the right to remove the remains, and the Arizona State Museum will determine what happens to them. Because of a 1927 deed restriction, Robson cannot build over the gravesite until the remains are removed. The final plat for Quail Creek's expansion, designated as a subdivided tract carved out from the surrounding residential lots. Under state law, the Arizona State Museum is responsible for protecting and overseeing the treatment of archaeological human remains found on state and private land outside of active cemeteries. State statutes require that the museum be notified immediately upon discovery of any remains buried at least 50 years ago. If and when the descendants come forward, the state consults with them to honor their wishes regarding the remains. When we inform descendant communities about the disturbances of human remains, we provide as much information as we can to help them make an informed decision about cultural connection and final disposition, said Kristen Lucas, repatriation coordinator with the Arizona State Museum. The museum works with the landowner, their contractor, and descendants of those interred to determine an appropriate outcome for the remains. Lucas said that while Arizona's burial statutes do not explicitly define the terms next of kin and lineal descendants, these relationships are ideally established through estate planning documents like a will, a trust, or beneficiary designation. If these are not specified, as is the case with most historical burials, Arizona's intestate succession laws default to a strict statutory order based on blood relationships, she said. Monica Christensen, who is the vice president of the Santa Cruz Valley Historical Society, used genealogical research to identify potential living heirs, including three descendants of Sawyer. They live in New York, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. Attempts by the Green Valley News to reach them were unsuccessful. What matters to me is just keeping the connection alive between the generations, Christensen said. I just hope he, that Sawyer, being somewhat peaceful and where he would want to be. Howard Elliott of New York, a grand-nephew of Florence Gorman, who claims to be her oldest living heir, told the Green Valley News on June 7th he doesn't want to disturb the gravesite. My desire would be to just leave it right where it is. There's a little plot there. I see no reason why they just shouldn't leave it, he said. Elliott said Gorman grew up on a dairy up farm in upstate New York, met Sawyer in high school and married before moving to southern Arizona. She married Nelson Sawyer, who was a schoolmate. He was a mining engineer. They moved to the Southwest. She loved the Southwest and never returned except for visits, he said. Lucas noted that in the absence of direct kin, the ASM director may consult with the groups that can show a relationship to human remains through cultural affinity, when American industry, Indian ancestry is involved, that a descendant of Gorman must, subject to a marriage, has no legal rights to the descendant's remains under Arizona law. Shortly after construction began in Quail Creek about 8 months ago, Santa Cruz Valley Historical Society President Mary Mac Chernosky voiced her concerns about Sawyer's gravesite to the project's foreman. He informed her the team had been instructed not to disturb the gravesite and to move the historic farming equipment once used on J.P. Bull Farms away from the construction zone. Chernosky, who lives in Quail Creek, later shared her concerns about the burial site and the historical remnants with Quail Creek General Manager Melanie Caron and Murphy Colossa, Senior Marketing Manager for Ropes and Resort Communities. They were aware of the historical significance of it, she said. Like Christensen, Chernosky did not learn of the public notice regarding the gravesite until several days after its publication. It's very sad because when you're made aware of the historical significance of something, you would think that they would give you the courtesy of contacting you and seeing what could be done, she said. In other words, maybe there's family that we don't know about, and we could have researched it and tried to get a hold of them and asked them what they wanted to do. Long before it was slated for master-planned luxury homes, native New Yorkers Nelson and Flo and Sawyer first came to the area to stake a claim on federal public land under the Homestead Act. Drawn to the area around 1910 because of the hot and dry climate to treat his tuberculosis, Sawyer's time on the property was short. He died at the age of 32 and was laid to rest on a hillside overlooking the old former Nogales Road in 1912. A story from the Morris Chronicle in New York reads, "He leaves a wife, Florence Naylor. They have been living in different parts of the West for several years, vainly seeking a beneficial climate for Mr. Sawyer's health. He was a talented young man with a host of friends, and to a surviving wife and sister, sympathy is extended." Florence eventually remarried, taking on the surname Gorman. Because Sawyer had been buried before the federal government formally issued a land patent signed by President Woodrow Wilson to Sawyer's heirs in 1913, the gravesite physically sat on land that eventually became part of the Motto family's holdings. Following Sawyer's death in 1912, Gorman inherited the 300-plus-acre homestead, and in 1927 she purchased a small burial plot from neighbors Antonio and Maria Iamano in a 1927 bargain and sale deed for $1. And I'll continue with this on Wednesday. Till then, Mark DeGroft, the reading of the Green Valley News. Take care.